Welcome back to the podcast. On this episode, I'm speaking with artist Simon Denny, who recently opened a solo exhibition at Petzl Gallery. That same week, Simon curated a group show on the second floor at Petzl Gallery and opened another solo show at Dunkunsthal, an artist-run project space founded by Rachel Rawson. These works frame big tech as both the colonial force of the 21st century and as a powerful tool for democracy and cooperative ownership. It's been an eventful week in New York City, at the end of which we all gathered downtown at TJ Burns to celebrate the launch of Simon's new book. My co-host for this episode is Julia Kagansky. This is a recording from the live event. You can find links for the book and all the exhibitions mentioned before in the show notes for this episode. Let's get into it.
An artist-run project space. It's run by Rachel, myself, Josh, and the wonderful Tony Tirador and Lila DeBass. We're super excited to have Simon's show in the space. So if you haven't been, please check it out.
And tonight we are celebrating the launch of Simon's book, Landscapes, which is published by Sorry Press, supported also by Petzl Gallery. The book includes essays and interviews with Christina Barton, Christopher Platz-Gallis, Stina Mays, Martin Herbert, Omar Khalif, Christina Barton, Fred Turner, based, Dina Glickson. Simon, maybe to start us out, would you tell us about the works that are on view in Read, Write, Own at Dunkunsthal and about the themes explored in the book, which features the same body of work in deeper resolution?
Absolutely. I also just want to have another little introduction moment as well, just saying thank you to Josh, to Julia, to Rachel, to Petzl Gallery, to Sorry Press. The founders of Sorry Press are also here. Great venue. This is a fantastic place to be. And thank you all for being here. There's been many events this week, so I appreciate the sustained engagement. Thank you very much. It's great to see everybody. Yeah, I mean, so the show Across the Street, Read, Write, On is actually named after another book. There's a book by investor Chris Dixon, who wrote a book recently, kind of about different paradigm shifts in the nature of the internet. And his claim is that ownership is a big part of what's coming in the web. For those of you who are familiar with kind of like crypto adjacent narratives or blockchain adjacent narratives, that is not like that's not a new story, but it's a story that I found really interesting, which I think intersects with this book a lot, Landscapes. The body of work that's in the show, but also the whole subject of this book. Every painting is a painting of somebody else's property in various different metaverses that have like crypto assets as the way of buying and selling those properties. So in these various metaverses, which became quite popular during the kind of recent crypto boom, is attached to an NFT. And the NFTs are often kind of representing pictorially sections of maps of various metaverses. At some moments in the kind of story of those metaverses, there have been people buying those properties. Sometimes they even build things, quote unquote, in those properties. But actually, a lot of the activity to date in those properties has been speculative in nature. So people buy and sell these NFTs in these metaverses to have a kind of like a bet on the future of what those properties might be like. And during very frothy moments around kind of the metaverse hype craze, which I guess is also in rather a low moment right now, these things were selling for quite a lot. There was even some stuff being built and parties being held in them, etc. But when I saw the way that these properties were depicted in these kind of square NFTs that are often in like a grid shape, they reminded me of like mid-century abstract painting, like particularly Decentraland, which is the first metaverse I painted images of the properties of. It's very much like a kind of, to me, it was like a Tron, Broadway boogie-woogie, something Mondrian-ish, but a little bit more techy. And I thought that would be, I thought it was actually a funny thing to try and paint them when I first saw them. I thought, oh, that would be hilarious to try and, you know, paint those. It looks like the steel, but it's not. And now it's like, oh, then they'd also be also images of territory, images of land. So therefore they'd be like landscape paintings. And that's where, you know, I came up with the kind of concept. But then I started to think more about what a landscape painting was, I guess also like structurally. And I grew up in New Zealand. I live in Germany, but I grew up in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, when one studied art history at the times that I did, and when I went to school, I got taught a lot about the history of landscape painting, because a little bit like here in the US, landscape painting is framed or has been framed educationally. Colonial landscape painting has been framed as some kind of like base starting point for some kind of art history canon. So like regional canons or something like that are often built in New Zealand from early landscape paintings by settlers.
And there's also been a lot of revisionist art history done about those series of paintings as, you know, not only paintings, but also as kind of advertisements for land acquisition. So often the people that would paint these landscape paintings were funded by companies who were part of the colonial project trying to sell the land. And so they're sort of like at both like art history and kind of speculative land project kind of devices. And the more I thought about that history and about landscape painting's role in kind of defining property value and kind of making a certain type of property market in New Zealand, the more I thought it was actually appropriate that these were landscape paintings because it was like a similar type of thing going on. There was kind of assets being invented, and these images were kind of representing those invented assets. And so I thought like painting those assets was actually kind of a more interesting thing to do than just a joke. And so I started to play around with like what the best materiality for that would be. And some of those landscapes are hanging across the street in Dunkonsau. And there's some sculptures there as well. But the book describes that process, describes this context. That's the basics.
One of the things that I really enjoyed in reading the book is understanding, you know, not only this history of landscape painting as a means of legitimating property ownership and, you know, how it's entangled in the history of settler colonialism, but also this connection to Read, Write, Own, which you kind of mentioned at the outset, and the parallels between a kind of enclosure of a commons, right? So like the web being this sort of digital commons that freely mixed and remixed and shared, and then the blockchain being something that introduces ownership into it. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that and those parallels, because I think that's, you know, just an insight that adds another layer to the landscape in this context.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when I first started making art and like showing art, this is like another art adjacent moment in a way for me. My friends and I, some of which are still in this room and like sitting along beside me, I think we were all excited about what it meant to like take a thing that was on the internet and just do something with it. There was a lot of a very liberal notion. In fact, there was a show at the New Museum, Free, I believe, which
Laura Cornell,
right,
for my time.
But that was like the first kind of post-internet show, maybe in New York, and it was actually built on this notion that one could just grab stuff and do things. It was sort of like a sampling adjacent world. And I think in that moment in art, making art alongside internets, there was a lot of taking and doing stuff with and putting back. And so exactly, it was a sort of commons-based experience. There was a sort of a license in a way, an implied license, even some designed licenses like Creative Commons, which I think was very celebrated at that time, coming up where one could just kind of do things. And actually my practice was based on that for a long time. I took a lot of things from companies. I took a lot of things from other artists, other people doing things, and I redeployed it. Obviously, there's like a longer art history to that as well of like appropriation, et cetera. But like, I was really excited in that moment around Free. And then when this kind of like blockchain adjacent thing came along and this whole like provenance layer was proposed, that notion was kind of like repositioned. And so I found this kind of disappearance of the commons, this enclosure of property, really compelling. I also found the more explicitly, like, I guess, asset creation aspect of like blockchain adjacent internet worlds being really interesting as well. And exactly, like, for those of us who are kind of familiar with stories of enclosure from Britain farms, et cetera, exported all over the world in the colonial context, it felt very close to that too. And I guess that's when I sort of started thinking about like abstraction as well, like in this other kind of sense, like a financial abstraction. As well as, the abstraction of space and stuff. So, yeah.
One thing that we haven't talked about with relation to these paintings, which I think is really remarkable, is the way that you've included three different forms of markets and valuation within a single work. And they all potentially compete for like which one is like the primary form of understanding the value here. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, this is something that's very succinctly pointed out in one of the texts, the first text in the book by Martin Herbert, actually, which is like the fact. So it's a painting, which is an asset. Right? One buys and sells paintings. That happens. They go up and down in value. That happens. So that's one sort of asset. Of course, they're images of another kind of asset, which is the property that one buys in this metaverse. And then they also contain a new NFT that I've made that kind of points to the owner of both of those properties. When one has the painting, you also get a little kind of like scratch card on the back of the canvas that I kind of stapled to it, which contains a secondary NFT, which points to the owner of the original and the owner of the painting. So there's like an NFT,
a land property and a kind of painting as an asset all in this one thing.
I actually have at home a very early metaverse landscape painting, and it was an early draft. It didn't come with an NFT.
That's true.
And I was wondering if you wanted to give me that. it feels a little incomplete.
Yes, I do. Oh, yes, that's fair. Yeah, that's fine.
I just wanted to get on the record. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for the kind of local history, the fact that we're sitting in this neighborhood is very significant for all of these histories, I would say. And one thing that makes this show Over the Street particularly resonant for me as an artist is I painted the first ones of these paintings in Rachel's studio upstairs. So I kind of worked on it in this neighborhood. She was generous enough to give me the space back then. But also there's been a strong financial asset history in this neighborhood, obviously being the financial district. And also it was a place where I understand many generations of artists, including abstract artists from the 1950s, were also working among these buildings, actually.
So Rauschenberg in the very building of Dunkunsthal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought that was all kind of interesting in terms of asset development and employment as well.
Speaking of finance and tech, you write in the book that there are certain themes within the tech world that have these boom and bust cycles. They disappear for a little while, and then they inevitably come back in this strange, literally resurrected form in some of your other works. I was wondering if you have thoughts about the imaginary of the metaverse, because a few years ago during, you know, peak COVID lockdowns and so on, it seemed like it was, you know, the metaverse proper, like from Meta, Facebook, Instagram, and so on.
Yeah.
That was being rolled out very quickly. This was happening at a really rapid pace. And then it kind of receded from the public imaginary. But now in the last few weeks, we have the Apple Vision Pro, which is making obviously a lot of memes and waves on the internet. And there's this other resurgence of just the metaverse as a kind of virtual commons or virtual space in the public imaginary. So I was wondering if you had thoughts about how our conception of the metaverse has shifted in the last few years.
Well, first time history, second time fast.
The third time love.
Third time love, yeah. But no, I don't know. I mean, I guess these are, you know, hype cycles are very important to value, I guess, around these topics, right? And I think like certain terms get kind of associated with some kind of level of excitement in particular communities. Capital gets deployed, people get excited, you know, whatever, articles are written, and then things don't quite go as fast as they maybe seemed like they would, or the adoption's not what it was. And then it seems like that those names and tags get like a little toxic, as well as the kind of asset values go down as well. I would say from my armchairs, we're in a moment where the metaverse as a term is kind of like maybe not so exciting for people, that it's not as exciting as it once that it was a couple of years ago. But then I think the notion of building an internet with kind of virtual worlds, like is in Read Write On, which is a contemporary book that's just come out now. I think the way of like building economies to sell in virtual kind of spaces is something that has kind of always been there through that hype cycle, but maybe not in these metaverses. I guess one of the things I got interested in when I was thinking about making this series is also like where these owning economies actually do exist. And those are more in like gaming worlds, right?
So right.
World of Warcraft worlds and other more contemporary worlds where you can buy and sell digital assets and have
huge economies.
Huge economies,
yeah.
Right.
Houses, yeah.
So I think that metaverse existed prior to the term becoming a hype cycle term, exists afterwards and will kind of continue on, I guess, as virtual economies grow. That's my...
Well, Rachel and I talk about this all the time, but I'm trying to remember if Snow Crash is 1992 or 1998. It's a sci-fi novel by Neal Stephenson, which coins the initial term, the metaverse, which has held for, you know, several decades now, this imaginary space of the virtual cyberpunk world. So it maybe recedes periodically and then resurges and so on. And I'm personally of two minds of this, because it's a weird position to be in where a lot of this stuff sounds super dystopian, but then the actually existing reality of internet economies is that we find ourselves in monopolistic feudal structures. In the context of feudalism, like capitalism is a relatively progressive force. There's something very unique about blockchain Web3 technologies in that in the emergence of capitalism from feudalism, we are definitely not seeing the formation of states on the blockchain. It's a confusing thing because you're in quite bad circumstances and some of these things are quite positive, but also can yield terrible, terrible results. So I'm wondering if maybe, because you spend a ton of time, you move through these worlds much more expediently than I do, but what is the utopian positive imaginary? Like, what is the best case that we can make for this thing? Like, the people who are building this, what are the dreams that they're trying to achieve?
I don't really know, right? It would be the short answer to that.
Is it because there's confusion among the people who are building it, or
no? I just don't see that as my role. I'm more a reactive documentary, I don't know, artist than like a projective kind of like utopian artist. I like to see something that's going on and kind of distill it into something and sort of mark it in cultural time and space or something like that. That's the way I see my role. I actually tend not to spend a lot of time thinking about whether that thing is great or horrible. It doesn't really enter my work production so much. I can see the arguments. Of course, like, it's not that I'm not thinking when I produce these things. I can see things that I'm attracted to. I can see things that I'm like not so into as an idea. I can see results of things that don't come out so great. Mm. And I can see results of things which kind of have promise. You know, as I guess work changes in format, I can see good ideas of having digital assets, having an economy. I participated to some degree in like an NFT art world. I saw some great art being produced with that format. And I also saw some different modes of compensation happening, some spectacularly big compensation moments, some quite small compensation moments. But I think there are artists making really interesting things in that format and selling them. So I guess, I don't know if that's a utopia, but that's definitely something that I like and I think has been a good enlarging of a media.
Yeah, I'm a complete evangelist for connecting artists with resources, which yeah. There was, you know, our peer group, our generation of artists, people making work that was largely on the internet, very difficult to sell. Some of them existed as websites or memes or what have you.
Right.
You have like a decade worth of very influential, canonized, would be shown in museums, institutions, and so on, but then was never connected with a collector class, never had a real class of patrons. And then a lot of those people were compensated for years of unpaid work, which is a phenomenal and extraordinary thing that we should celebrate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were adjacent to many of these things as well.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit. But actually, what I wanted to say was actually related to Josh's previous question. About the kind of utopian imaginaries related to the metaverse, because this work just made me think about how these things always bleed out into the physical world. These kind of feudalist projects that they are funding or enabling in the real world. So everything from Bajali Srinivasan's like network state proposition and venture capitalists that are trying to bring that about, whether it's, you know, Vitalik and Zuzalu in Montenegro or Thiel and Prospero in Honduras, like, right. I do kind of see, I don't know if you would agree to this, but I see kind of a direct link between these like virtual real estate projects and claims to corral a group of people to build a virtual utopia with these instantiations in the real world.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I might point back to the book with regards to that, because there's one of the other pieces of writing that I'm very excited about in this book is a little new essay by Fred Turner, who wrote this very well-known book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, which talks, I think, a lot about these things in a more historical, in-depth way, right? The arc from the fantasies of the outside, from like moving outside of kind of mainstream state culture. In this case, the book starts with like the hippie movement in the 1960s and you know, various different versions of independent state-like attempts with the communities, and then kind of how that gets built into the kind of digital economy through the 90s and up until Facebook. And I think I feel that the kind of more contemporary attempts from people like Balaji, Vitalik, and yeah, Prospero, Zuzalu, I think these things have a continuity with that past as well. So this is maybe like a more contemporary, articulated, more 2024 version of a similar type of force, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the impulse to like leave society and start all over with like your 20 best friends who all have the same ideology as you is not a new one.
right. But not even not just a new one as that, but like more like, I guess I see a continuity between the cultures of this particular community, like people that enjoy building businesses based on the internet or whatever, you know, or based on computing, or I don't know, you know, so it's more specific than just a group of people with some friends. It is indeed people that are interested in these particular kinds of economies and technologies as well, right?
And so, yeah, and I think the conflation between a corporation and a nation state is something that, you know, has been in the air for the last couple of decades.
The libertarians are always trying to fudge the definition of property. My definition of property, which is the right definition of property, is that you are purchasing the legal use of force from the state. So you own this place. If somebody comes into your house, you're allowed to force them out at gunpoint because you have sovereign property ownership of that territory. If a bunch of people come in, the state will send the police and the SWAT teams and so on. So if you have it, you know, written in a paper agreement with, say, for example, Honduras, and then the president is ousted and there is a historic unanimous, imagine any Congress in the world having a unanimous agreement that this claim to property is illegal, they will send in the tanks. Hmm. And then these people will very quickly learn the real definition of property, which is purchasing the legal use of force from the state. And it's not cryptographically sealed anywhere. That's that was my little podcast in the middle of.
But what about these properties I made painting jobs? Like,
well, I mean, I think the thing that is especially interesting about all of this is that as these organizations, which are building quasi-political parties on the internet, you know, meeting each other through social media and so on, they are, to use the word, devirtualizing into the real world, where the effective altruists purchase a castle to have their annual conferences. It is always kind of resolved in some kind of real territory. So obviously, non-contiguous network states are the clearest distillation of that process. But it's a difficult thing because then you have to really meaningfully define property. And if someone comes with a certificate on the blockchain and then the National Guard says differently, that's a clash of sovereignties, you know? So the withering of nation states, the rise of network states, it's a dispute over the definition of property and value. Those things are ideological. It's the history of the 20th century all over again.
You know, I think one of the things that I really appreciate about your work is the way that you investigate these places where the digital and the physical meet. What I really loved, like looking closely at these paintings, is the way that you represented that in the physical paintings themselves.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the process of that and the textures and, and the actual materials at play here.
I mean, exactly. These are paintings, first and foremost, in some ways. And paintings are about looking at an object on a wall, and it's about a surface and your encounter with that and the kind of poetry between gesture and form and all these things that painters spend a lot of time thinking about and working on. And so I wanted to enter into that discourse, into that conversation meaningfully. I take them very seriously as paintings. I guess paintings that have incorporated elements of print technology has also a long and kind of specific history, and maybe loudest being pop art in general. That kind of strain of painting I find really compelling, and I had in my mind also when I was making these. And recently, like UV print technology has become something other. Like when I first started working with UV printers and making canvases, which I've used in many installations over the years, one could only really like use like a flatbed press off a roll. You had like a roll of canvas and you kind of printed it, and if you couldn't get it through the little hole that the roll was, then you couldn't do anything with it. But more recently, the technology has become more versatile, where you can kind of like take the UV print kind of printing head off the roll flatbed and have like a vertical and a Z axis. So I came across this company, and there are many companies doing it, but I came across a German company, I live in Germany, who are producing a UV printer that you could kind of like put on a little stand. It was made for printing on, for example, this brick wall. So if you had like lots of bumps and shit and it was like on a wall, you could use this press to kind of like print on it. So you could print your branding on your coffee wall or whatever. I was like, oh, that's exciting, because then you can do that on like a crazy surface, which usually these printers would like break because of. And so I started to experiment with like actually painting layers or printing layers of UV print on wet canvas surfaces. Like, so I would like get very gestural with my oil paint, and I like using oil paint for these things. And I would kind of come in with like layers of UV print on the top of that. And that would be like this immediate weird, like dry film on top of like a very gluggy undersurface that was still drying. And that would do interesting things when those layers intersected. But it also gave me a lot of like room to play where I could kind of disrupt those surfaces and then print on them again. So there's a lot that you can do now, all of a sudden, where you can kind of like make the gestural meet, like, I guess, traces of something that is more legible as digital, like this printing process, in a much more exciting way. So this is where I kind of started to dive into the materiality of making these prints, because I wanted them to be exactly what you said, like this meeting point of the digital and the kind of like chunky, the analog world or whatever. And so I wanted, when you kind of see them and stand in front of one of these paintings, of course, they're this kind of conceptual object on the one hand, but they're also this kind of meeting point of something virtual, something abstract, like financially abstract, something kind of like very thin, and something really chunky. And so I spent a lot of time like playing around with what those different things would do. You can move the nozzle away from the surface, you get a slightly more dispersed image. You can kind of like, I don't know, there's so many amazing things. And so that's, I really got lost in those surfaces.
It also makes them utterly unique, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Painting is a better form of cryptography than direct prints, indeed.
Very hard to reproduce as well. This is the thing when you kind of like get in there with the gesture, you know, it's no two attempts at the same thing would be the same. Having said that, I did have like rules for my production. There is no two paintings of the same piece of property.
Right.
Like I wanted to have like one property per painting. There's a lot of metaverse properties in the world, so in theory one could do many, many paintings, but none of them would depict the same land.
How did you select the land that you chose to depict?
So that was a combination of things. So there's many metaverses which represent property ownership in this way. I picked the five most visible that I could see, like the people that were using and trading them a lot, like the ones with the most activity. I mean, again, there are many definitions of a metaverse that you can buy a piece in and then build in a virtual property with using the ownership of that space or whatever. And so I picked Decentraland, The Sandbox, Crypto Voxels, Somnium Space, and a Loot Realms one. There's probably nobody in this room that knows these things. But anyway, they are used and kind of loved by certain communities. And one of the reasons I picked them was high usage. The other reason was because they had this kind of interesting relationship to the imagery that I thought they were doing as well. And this is, I guess, like another art reason, art interest to make these paintings is, as I say, they have this resemblance to other moments in painting, right? So like Decentraland in particular, I mentioned already, has some kind of relationship to a Broadway Boogie Woogie like grid. I found that compelling to paint and to play with. Voxels, which actually there's kind of three of them in the show across the street, looks like a strange to steal thing. It's much more kind of, it's a much more open grid, but there's also street names on it. So it's as if you put a street name on a wider to steal painting. The one that's on the cover of this book is from The Sandbox, and that has a more kind of 90s pop art vibe to it. So there's more images, because when you buy a section of property, you can change the image that is represented on the NFT map. So there's like a Pokemon figure, there's a punk, people have put their PFP on their property. So in a way, there was a compositional, interesting kind of pop thing that was happening with those ones. And so within those definitions, I then selected the ones which made the most interesting conversations with my, I guess, revisionist landscape modernists.
Have you had anybody who has gotten in touch with you and they're like, hey man, why are you painting my backyard? this is my property, you're not allowed to be here.
Yeah.
You can't take pictures.
Actually, no. Interestingly, I haven't had that happen. And they have circulated in places where I guess people are in these worlds. I mean, people from Decentraland, we spoke. So I spoke to the creative director of Decentraland, and there was some conversations about whose property I was making images of, but he knew some of the people, but that never kind of got any further. I have selected a painting, which is in the show across the street, of quite a well-known NFT artist who has made his own museum in that metaverse. But that was on my part. I knew that it was his property when I painted it. So Stevie P, he had a really interesting NFT project where he picked up religious pamphlets from the subway in New York. Oh, wow. And every time he would pick one up, he would photograph it and sell it as an NFT. And so he has kind of like a really interesting NFT crypto-backed archive of Jesus pamphlets, as he calls them. And he has a virtual church in one of the metaverses, in the Crypto Voxels metaverse. And I made a painting of his property that has that church in it. So that's maybe one example of a kind of interaction with an ownership, but that rather came from my side. And I think when I told Stevie about it, he kind of giggled, and that was it.
How, while building a museum is a certain type of a project, what's your sense of how many people are in this space, judging by the turnover of the properties? Because a museum, obviously, this is something that is going to last for hopefully hundreds of years.
Ever, Stuart, forever.
In the future.
Yeah.
Right. And then other properties are ostensibly undeveloped and are just held as a speculative asset, turnover a million times. Do you have a sense of the scale? You know, how much of this is speculation and how many people are building durable institutions that are going to last and be open to the public and so on?
So my understanding right now of the activity in these metaverses is it's very, very low, both speculatively and kind of in terms of building. There's a lot of empty properties. There's a lot of things that were built very quickly that don't have a lot of users in them.
Right.
When I've visited these properties, I've had a look at what some of these properties look like, and I'm often there on my own, like waiting for a virtual friend. So it's a little quiet on the front, so to speak. But I think that's quite interesting in terms of the way that they behave. Like, I think, again, like coming back to the kind of, I guess, colonial landscape idiom, I also see these as kind of snapshots in development in time. Actually, some of the interfaces have changed. In fact, one of the paintings that's in the show across the street, in The Sandbox, they have changed their UX. So the property actually looks nothing like the painting now. And so I see that as a kind of like early settler image, maybe, of a landscape. I think also in terms of usage, that's another reason why I think like showing at Dunkelnsthalle was like an interesting thing to do, because it's a kind of a, it's another usage of a space that had a previous commercial reason to exist, right? And it's something that the space has kind of kept some of the identity of one of the many Dunkin' Donuts on the street, actually.
That's four of them.
Phenomenal. But anyway, I just think the fact that there's a kind of relic aspect and a kind of, I guess, maybe disused, bankrupt aspect of the space, which attracted me a lot. Yeah.
We talked before about Web2 structures emulating feudalism, and then there's this progression towards capitalism, and then you eventually arrive at socialism, this Hegelian Marxist teleology of history. And now there's another competing theory that I hear come from a lot of blockchain Web3 type of communities, where they describe the development of human civilizations as kingdoms into states and then into networks. I'm trying to figure out if those are parallel theories, if they are mutually exclusive, where people plot themselves in between those different poles. Do you have a sense of like where you fall on that spectrum between these competing or parallel teleologies?
Maybe, but it might be a bit disappointing because I find both claims a little rigid to my experience of how the world goes, you know? And so I find everything a little fuzzier, and I find those designs actually a little abstract in both senses. I find the kind of Marxist version that I learned in university a little abstract to my experience of how stuff goes. And I find the claims in a book like Bellagio's Network State, which lays out these time histories you're talking about, I find that also a little abstract, and like it does, it's like a t-shirt that looks great on the shelf, and when I try it on, like, am I really wearing this t-shirt? You know, like, does it really fit my body? So I find both a little awkward and abstract. You know,
there's like a niche group of people on the internet that there's like a anarcho-capitalist dissolution of the state that results in worker cooperatives on the blockchain.
Yeah.
That's like the apex 3D chess.
Well, I find all these little kind of sub-microcultures where there's like fantasies and models described about fantasy worlds. I find them culturally compelling. I find the energy in those spaces to be really interesting. And I find the stories that are told to be very interesting as well, but I don't see a lot of relationship to the world in those stories. I see them more as like about those people in those groups, you know, so that I know that that's not the inception of probably the people who are in those groups, and maybe it's a little unfair to reduce it to something like a cultural murmur, but that's where I consume it, right? Like I'm like, oh, that's a really interesting model to describe how these people feel about politics right now. But I don't take it as a proposition that has a truth value or whatever.
I guess my hope is that there are so many gamer economies that are so fascinating and then build all of these innovative but also equitable models of how to compose a community. And so there's kind of a direct line through gamer economies into experiments in the metaverse, which can then be translated to real property ownership in the real world. That's the long hope for the project.
But it's interesting that I think the play space, this fantasy space that exists in game worlds, allows people to play out a certain kind of politics, you know, this fundamentally like socialist political structure, but that doesn't necessarily translate into that group of people identifying with that political ideology. In fact, they very likely reject it. Exactly.
Yeah,
right. So there's a kind of an ironic relationship that people have to the way that they understand politics in fantasy spaces.
But this cuts the other way in that like a lot of the strident libertarianism of a lot of Web3 crypto spaces end up building cooperative models of ownership, reinventing things that diagrammatically look like worker cooperatives that you've heard from the 20th century history of the left, but they're coming from this, as people would identify in that space, you know, largely libertarian leaning, anti-state and so on. So it's a very interesting convergence of these things that makes me, you know, in some cases a bit optimistic for it.
Mm. I recently did something that's maybe adjacent to this that I can speak maybe more directly to, is I was asked to do a talk about virtual labor now or something like this, you know. And I was really interested in, within these virtual economies that you were also talking about, the figure of the non-player character that many people are also attracted to, right? This it's a very compelling container. And I did a sort of micro history of like how NPCs have been compensated in various different online economies. Huh. From early kind of EverQuest gaming worlds through to like Roblox-y types of things now. And it was interesting because in some virtual economies, you know, NPCs earn quite well. They're compensated for their non-human labor quite handsomely.
Huh.
In other economies, they're completely ignored. The NPC never earns a dime. I think it's quite interesting to see how these virtual models, which I think is kind of what they're kind of playable models, right? Ironically, how they imagine the other, right? And an NPC is by definition an other. They're a non-agent, right? And how do you compensate non-agents? And I thought that was like...
What does an NPC do with a salary?
Well, that we never know, you know? That's not true. Sometimes you see them also in these virtual economies spending their money on stuff or spending their time and labor on stuff as well. Like, I can't remember the gaming metaverse. I think it's EverQuest maybe. It's one version of EverQuest where you can do a hack, a mod of it where the NPCs come together and then revolt. I have to look that up for you. But yeah, because that's quite cute as well. Can imagine thinking of a non-agent revolting. Anyway, yeah.
That sounds like a model of like the perfect consumer, right? Like an NPC that like they all spend money. Amazing.
Yeah.
They crack the code. Should we open it up to questions?
Yeah, we'll do two questions or something like that. And we'll roll a few together.
Talk about the sculpture. I want to hear about sculpture.
Oh, that's true.
You want the sculpture boards.
Okay, well, that's nothing to do with this book, so that's really not for this conversation at all. Across the street in the show, there are these paintings, but there are also other types of property. So I made some sculptures that are made from another kind of property with significant provenance, I would say. So I bought a bunch of whiteboards, sight unseen, from an auction of disused office equipment from Twitter that Elon Musk liquidated when he took over X, saying all sorts of things about how indulgent the Twitter space was. They had pizza ovens and all sorts of horrible things you shouldn't have in offices. Anyway, so he sold a bunch of stuff and I bought, sight unseen, a bunch of whiteboards. And I was secretly hoping that on the whiteboards would be some drawings made by people working at Twitter. And indeed, there were some drawings on those whiteboards. And I have made those into sculptures, which kind of are wall-mounted perpendicular hangings of these objects. So they kind of divide a space. They turn into a little bit like a room divider or like a booth sectioning system. A little bit like these objects in the...
Or a cubicle.
Or a cubicle or something like that out of them. And I also did another insertion with them where I laser cut a plus symbol into the middle of those objects. So you have like a little window in a way in the shape of a kind of a cross or an X in there where you can kind of like look through the boards. To me, I thought that was a really interesting thing to do to those objects because they sort of turn into, room dividers, windows. The cross is kind of like an interesting symbol there because it's like a target finder. Is it a divider? They look a little bit like a turret in a castle, I thought, where you kind of poke your arrow out or whatever. Yeah, and they also kind of... Yeah, very feudal, exactly. And I thought they also literally divided up the territories in the space too. So, but I thought as a group show making exercise in that context, it was cool because it was yet another kind of distressed asset, right? Or something like that. It was something with a significant provenance that kept some of its past, but was kind of like something of territory. I also like the idea of whiteboards being both spaces of gesture that happen like in offices and in startups or whatever, where people are designing things, and that there's a gesture made there. So there's a painterliness to those things in some ways. And also it's literally like a planning board, right? It's like where you plan infrastructure. And I think something that is also stuck in my mind with the idiom of landscapes is also again, from my own history, knowing, all this planning often happens in one domain, execution happens in another, and often these things are a bit of an awkward fit. So the kind of, I guess, the planning space is something that I found really compelling about those whiteboards as well.
Thank you so much for so generously sharing with us about this project. It was a really great conversation.
Yes, thank you all for being here. It's so great to talk to you. And also, like, hang around. I'll be here all evening. So if you want to chat or ask questions, also.
Go see the show across the street.
Go see the show across the street. Yeah.
Uptown at Petzl.
Right. I have another couple shows uptown at Petzl Gallery, which is very exciting, too. Different, entirely different thing. Thank you very much, Josh.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
next one.